Good morning, and welcome to the City of Miami Beach Historic Preservation Board meeting. Today's February 14th, 2023. We have a short agenda today, and we're still expecting a couple board members to arrive. But in the meantime, we'll get started with just a quick overview of our sequence here. When we have staff call an item, they'll describe the recommendations, and the board will have an opportunity to ask questions directly to the staff. After that, we'll invite the applicants to come up and make their presentations, and then go ahead and sit back down so that the board can raise questions that they may have directly to the applicant. We'll have we'll ask the applicant to take note of any questions that may come up and answer them all together so as to avoid a kind of back and forth. And then we will open the public hearing and give the applicant an opportunity to respond. After that, we'll have our board member comment one by one, ending with the chair. And hopefully at that point, we'll be ready to make a motion and make a decision. So with that, I'll turn it over to Debbie.
Good morning, members of the board, members of the public. Welcome to the February 14th Historic Preservation Board meeting. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Just a couple quick announcements. We are expecting to have a full board shortly. We have one new board member, Brian Ehrlich, who has replaced Nancy Liebman's seat. He should be joining us within about a half an hour or so. But I see we have six board members present currently. Other than that, I don't have any other announcements, but I will turn it over to Mr. Steve Rothstein from the City's Attorney's Office, who will read the notice for lobbyist registration and swear in any members of the public wishing to testify today.
Good morning, members of the board. Good morning to all. Today's meeting of the Historic Preservation Board has been scheduled in a hybrid format, with members of the board physically present in commission chambers at Miami Beach City Hall, and applicants, staff, and members of the public appearing either in person or virtually via the Zoom platform. In order to participate in today's meeting, members of the public may dial 1-888-475-4499, which is a toll-free number, and enter the webinar ID, which is 7488. So let me repeat that again. 817-4834-7488, or log into the Zoom app and dial the webinar ID, which again is 817-4834-7488. Any individual wishing to speak on an item must click the raise hand icon if they are using the Zoom app, or dial *9 if they are participating by phone. Individuals who wish to provide testimony or submit evidence in person may appear in the commission chambers on the third floor of Miami Beach City Hall at 1700 Convention Center Drive. Before I swear in the public, I'd like to read the city's notice regarding lobbyist registration. If you are appearing on behalf of a business, a corporation, or another person, you need to register as a lobbyist with the city clerk's office. If you haven't registered yet, you should register before you speak to the board. You don't have to register as a lobbyist if you are speaking only on your behalf and not on any other party, or if you're testifying as an expert witness, providing only scientific, technical, or other specialized information or testimony in this public meeting, or if you're appearing as a representative of a neighborhood association without any compensation or reimbursement for your appearance to express support or opposition to any item. Expert witnesses and representatives of neighborhood associations shall, prior to appearing, disclose in writing to the city clerk their name, address, and the principal on whose behalf they are communicating. If you are an architect, attorney, or employee representing an applicant or an objector, you must register as a lobbyist. These rules apply whether you are appearing in favor of or against an item, or encouraging or arguing against its passage, defeat, modification, or continuance. At this time, I'd like to swear in the members of the public that are here in chambers. If you would please stand and raise your right hand. Okay. Do you swear under oath that any and all testimony that you give in this proceeding is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. You may be seated. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Stephen. The first order of business this morning is the approval of the January 10th, 2023 minutes. We need a motion and a second.
A second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, so that passes. The second order of business on the agenda this morning is the election of a chair and vice chair. We placed this on the agenda in anticipation of the commission appointing the two open seats, which were Commissioner Liebman's seat and Mr. Pascal's seat. Mr. Pascal is joining us again today because his seat was not filled. This will be his last meeting. He is no longer, after today, eligible to attend any more meetings, regardless if the commission appoints someone for his seat or not. So first of all, I wanted to thank Kirk again for his service and his contribution to this board. We really enjoyed you and appreciate all of the hard work and effort you put into reviewing these applications. So it's up to the board. We could shelve this until we have Mr. Ehrlich join us. We could put it to the March meeting, or we could take it up now. It's up to you. I normally recommend that we wait until we have a new full board. Does everyone agree? Okay, so we're going to move that to the March 14th meeting. Moving on, we do have one request for continuance this morning. This is HPB 220551, 4000 Collins Avenue. This is an application requesting a certificate of appropriateness for the construction of a partial one-story rooftop addition and an active roof deck. We have been contacted by the applicant, who is making some relatively minor changes. However, they wanted to present the final full design to this board, so they are asking for a continuance to the March 14th meeting, and staff has no objection to this. We will need to open the public hearing on this, so any members that are present in chambers who wish to speak, please come to the podium. Anyone on Zoom, please raise your hand. Okay, Mr. Chair, I see no public comment at this time. We can close the public hearing and we can take a motion. Okay, do we have a second? Okay, second by Mr. Stewart. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, that has been continued to the March 14th meeting. The next application on the agenda is HPB 210476. This is 1426 Lenox Avenue. An application has been filed requesting a certificate of appropriateness for the construction of an accessory building within the rear yard and variances from the required setbacks, lot coverage, and open space requirements. The board did review this particular application at the January 10th meeting. At that meeting, we were advised by the applicant that they wanted some additional time to discuss the project with their immediate neighbor. I believe that discussion has took place, and they are back before you today with exactly the same plans that were presented to you at the January meeting. Real quick, since our analysis and our recommendation is consistent with what we presented in the January meeting, the property is a contributing building within the Flamingo Park Local Historic District. The existing structure was constructed in 1940. Designed by David T. Ellis in the Med Deco style of architecture. The applicant is requesting a two-story accessory building within the rear yard. Staff is supportive of this modest addition, and we believe the scale, massing, and architectural character is consistent with the surrounding historic district. With regard to the variances, the first variance is to exceed by 2.52% the maximum permitted lot coverage of 30%. The second variance is to exceed by 2% the maximum permitted accessory building lot coverage of 25%. And the third and the fourth variances are related to setbacks. There's one variance that's requesting to reduce by 5 feet the minimum required interior side setback. And that's from the north property line. And then finally, there's a variance to reduce by 13 feet the minimum required rear setback of 15 feet. The requested variances are all related to the construction of this new accessory building. Staff believes that the retention of the existing contributing home, which has a significantly larger setback at the front than what is required. The front of the existing home is set back approximately 50 feet from the property line. This is a practical difficulty and reduces the amount of area that the applicant has to construct the addition. We also noted in our analysis that that if this particular property was located outside of a historic district, they would have certain incentives for the retention of the existing home. Those incentives are not eligible to single-family homes that are located within historic districts. We also did find that presents a practical difficulty that the applicant cannot follow, for example, the existing setbacks, that they have to comply with the required setbacks. The west side of the property is immediately adjacent to an alley, which abuts a solely commercial district. We do find that this is a very unique situation where we have single-family homes abutting a commercial district, and we do believe that relief from the setback is warranted. The interior side setback is being requested to follow the existing setback. So with that, we are recommending approval, and I am available for any questions if you have them.
Any board member have questions for Debbie? No? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy Valentine's Day. Okay. My name is Wesley Castellanos. I'm a registered architect. I'm here in representation of the applicant of 1426 Lenox Avenue. If I may just briefly just discuss the project, not really give it a formal presentation, but discuss how we came to this position. When we first engaged the project, the first project was to basically rehabilitate the entire existing home, the contributing 1940s structure. So we pulled the permit, we renovated the entire home, and it's exactly to what it was originally. We didn't do, other than the garage conversion, was the major aspect of the project. So the home was well-preserved and brought up to date to current code. So within the project, the owner fell in love with the area more, and he wanted to develop this guest house. So this guest house that has come upon you is basically to accommodate in-laws' quarters, his parents. And when we came to the design, we basically found that the northwest corner was the only area that was able to accommodate a guest house and an ample backyard. So when these are the requests for the variances, so the variances were for the north and the west setbacks. So that being said, we actually, at the last presentation, we had the neighbor, and right now we have the neighbor's attorney here, Mr. Tucker Gibbs. If you want to mention something now, or should we wait for public comment? Okay, we'll wait for open comment. So we discussed with the neighbor the design. We actually went through three different design scenarios, positioning, as we discussed in that last presentation, to see which one fit best. And ultimately, we came back to the original design. So we did exercise different options to see how it would work. And basically, in the exercise, we found that it really would take away from the backyard, so you wouldn't even have a backyard. So that was the design options when we came back. So now we're here today, and the request was basically to propose this architecturally pleasing, in my opinion, two-story guest house overlooking the backyard and maintaining and preserving the existing structure that's there. Thank you.
Okay. Does the board have any questions for the applicant at this time? No? We have one.
Sorry.
Oh, yes. So actually, one item that is not illustrated on the drawings is that we decided to put a green wall on the north side of that elevation so that it's not on the drawings. It's probably going to be an item that's contingent for approval, hopefully, would be to have that the north elevation fully landscaped with a green wall. So that was the discussion.
I think if I may speak on behalf.
I don't want to speak on her behalf, but yeah, we discussed it.
Thank you.
I guess
if that's it for questions, then yes.
We'll do disclosures and open the public hearing. At that time, Mr. Tucker can come up. Right? Or did you have a question, too?
I do have a question, which maybe goes back to staff. I'm just curious about this because the Flamingo Park has multifamily structures, single-family structures. From the aerial view, it looks like the positioning of this residence is similar to those that are abutting it, sort of. And I was just curious, in terms of the FAR, there's not an FAR restriction listed. So it looks like it's really just a lot coverage. Is the FAR such a amount that it's really not pursuable? I was just curious about that.
I mean, I think that's a good question. In residential single-family zoning districts, which this is located in, there is no FAR. What we have for single-family zoning districts is unit size. This particular project is below the allowable unit size. So they're not seeking any relief for unit size, just for the lot coverage.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Should we ask for disclosures? Public hearing? Does anybody have anything to disclose with regard to this applicant?
Yeah, I received the note from the city. I don't know whether we disclose things that come through city hall or to planning to us, but like MDPL's...
Those communications are all part of the record. Perfect. Anything that's coming through us, so those don't need to be disclosed at the hearing.
Thank you.
Even if we got a second copy from that, right? No, if you send us something but we already received it, it's the exact same communication.
Correct.
Just to make sure.
Okay, if there's no disclosures, we can open the public hearing. Anyone in chambers wishing to speak, please come forward. Anyone on Zoom, please raise your hand.
At this time, we can ask the applicant to have a seat.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Tucker Gibbs. I represent Sarah Wright, who has the property immediately to the north, and I'm here today representing her to say that she has no objection to this application as presented here today.
Yes, hi, Daniel Seraldo with Miami Design Preservation League. Welcome, John, nice to see you. And Brian, hopefully he's on his way. Yes, we are in support of this project. This is a great example of historic preservation of single family homes, which we all know in Miami Beach is not going very well. So we're very thankful to this applicant who is restoring their home. One question we had during the process is about the muntins and the front facade. Will everything be sort of as it was originally, Debbie, with the restoration? And overall, we're very supportive. Thank you.
See no one on Zoom.
Okay. The applicant could respond if you'd like. Otherwise, we'll go on to board comments.
Yes, Daniel. Yes, one of the items that Debbie brought up to us was to bring up on the front facade the muntins. So bring back all those characters and try to bring back the original colors. So we brought back the colors, and there's actually reveals on it. So those reveals will actually be expressed with different colors. But so it's pretty much being brought back to the original, including the guest house in the rear. So in the guest house in the rear, it has muntins as well on the facade. So it kind of reflects. And when we were doing the architecture, we tried to add like a cornice and awnings and all these elements to bring a 1940 structure elements back into there. But yes.
Okay, and with that, we can go on to board member comment. Anybody like to start?
Stuart. Okay, thank you. No, I appreciate all of the support that the application has from the community and staff and the neighbor. I think it indicates that it's a thoughtful design, and it's a good design. My issue with it, which people who've been on the board with and in these chambers before will know that I point out each time that the law and the variance is not something optional that you could just give a wink and a nod to it. We have a zoning code that applies to everybody, and a variance isn't just something to give because it's a good plan or the neighbor likes it, or it's just a little bit, it's not that much of a variance. It's fine, variances are there for very important purposes. Variances are there when somebody can't essentially make a reasonable use of their property on the way the law is, and the law is having an unfair effect on the applicant. Now, the only thing I heard about the variance was from the staff today. That and basically was that because the house is set back from the street more than maybe others in the neighborhood, it's a practical difficulty. The staff report also says, as it ought to say somewhere, that the applicant submitted plans and documents with the application that indicate the following as they relate to the requirements of Section 118-353D of the Miami Beach City Code. Section 118-353 is the section that pertains to variance applications, and it has 8 criteria in Section D, and it says the board shall find. To make a finding, you need to have evidence. We are a quasi-judicial board. We're not just a board to say, wow, this is a great design. I like the design. I'm in support of nice design in our city. We're not just policymakers. It's a quasi-judicial board. We're here to uphold the law. So, you know, I'm sure we need to support good design, but we also need to support it within the requirements of the law. Now, although the staff report says that the applicant submitted plans and documents that indicate the following as they relate to the requirements of Section 118-353, there was nothing in the presentation about the requirements, which I'll read what the law says, and there was nothing in the materials either. So there was nothing before us for us to make findings that the requirements of the law have been satisfied. It's not just that there's a practical difficulty. This subsection D of 118-353, the first criteria, it says special conditions and circumstances exist which are peculiar to the land, structure, or building involved. Well, I suppose this greater than the other neighbors, the setback, maybe that's the special condition. Two, the special conditions and circumstances do not result from the action of the applicant. I'm not sure about that. Granting the variance requested will not confer on the applicant any special privileges that's denied by these land development regulations. Well, if somebody else applies and their application exceeds the lot size, exceeds the coverage, exceeds the setback requirements, they might not be. So it does give a special privilege. Literal interpretations of these land development regulations would deprive the applicant of rights commonly enjoyed by other properties in the same zoning district. I don't even know if there was a design considered for this in-law house that could have met the requirements. I'll bet with, because you see that this the guest house is separated from the existing structure, the design. If it were not separated, we wouldn't be running into the setback variance issue. And if it was a little smaller, we wouldn't be running into the coverage issue. So I think that the property owner could have gotten a design to accomplish what they wanted, a great design that fit the requirements of the law. And I think that's what the city owes the public and the applicants, to let them know, oh, if you're applying for a variance, you have to be able to prove these conditions. And if you don't, then submit an application that fits within the requirements of the law. So the variance granted is the minimum variance that will make possible the reasonable use of the land. Okay, that there's nothing that's before us to show that the house could have been a little smaller, or we don't know that it was the minimum variance that would make a reasonable possible use of the land. So I have nothing bad to say about the application. I'm just saying that without being able to make a finding, because there's no evidence before us that satisfies the requirements of the law, I can't support a variance, and I don't think that it's good practice for the city to do so, because if the law doesn't fit because if so many applications come before us with variances, it means maybe the law needs to be redrafted, the zoning code, so that people can submit applications that do satisfy the requirements of the law. But that's not our job. Our job is to uphold the law. And a variance is great when it satisfies the requirements of the law and the purposes of the variance.
Thank you, Stuart. Someone else? Kirk?
So I wanted to respond to what you said, Stuart, and I appreciate your saying it. I said at the last hearing, I think for most property owners in this city, you rely on the code to protect the interests of your property, setbacks being a big part of that. I've also been involved in plenty of discussions where the city is trying to look at particular neighborhoods and their needs and trying to develop code around that, whether it be for economic incentivization purposes, resilience purposes. I mean, there's a lot of pressures on different neighborhoods of this city to maintain economic viability and vibrancy. And looking at this particular application, you could at least see from, I guess it's page A004, in that neighborhood there seems to be, within that small section, relative consistency in terms of the front yard setbacks, which seem to be set back pretty substantially from the street. All of those back up to a commercial alleyway, which, but I don't know how expansive that condition actually is, and Debbie referenced it being kind of rare. And so ideally, in my mind, I think, first of all, I think it's great that the applicant is coming forward with a proposal to and in some ways, I guess, setting a model of sorts to bring greater economic viability, vibrancy, renovating an existing historic single-family home, retaining it, not discussing demolishing any of it, and I think that's wonderful. In a perfect world, I think maybe the neighbors could rely on having the same opportunity, right, that they could come in and do the same thing. But changing the code is a big process. It's a big process, and therefore, sometimes in these sort of instances, You get these sort of applications for variances, and maybe, you know, maybe the new construction, the new dwelling spaces, square footage could be crammed into a little area. But I feel like at least we had the engagement of the immediate neighbor. And to some extent, even though, you know, it would be great if we had the whole neighborhood here and you were able to develop widespread consensus, but between the two most effective parties, there seems to be consensus that they agreed on a path forward. And I would hope for the neighbor to the north that maybe, you know, someday that if she's agreeable to what's happening, then maybe it would be a path forward for her home as well. If she wanted to increase the square footage, maybe create some sort of economic, again, viability, whether it be for resilience purposes or just to make sense of renovating a historic property. So I understand exactly what you're saying. Stuart, I think you're exactly right on that regard, that many homeowners are sitting at home relying on the zoning code is going to protect my property. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow with a bulldozer and a crane and find some horrific thing going up next to me. But in a microcosm like this, I think sometimes it does fall on this board to make those decisions and to police it, and maybe this would be the precedent, right, of what was done there and what could be done somewhere else. In this particular instance, I find the renovation of the contributing structure to be a positive. I think the introduction of the new dwelling space to be compatible and respectful, and given the support of the neighbor, I'm supportive of it, although with regard to what you're saying, Stuart, I completely agree that ideally the code would reflect continuity and consistency so that everyone would know, well, this is the vision, right? This is the vision, and ideally you have consensus. But given the current situation, I think it's amazing that the neighbor took the time to come and speak and that inroads were created, and I'm supportive for those purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirk. Ray?
Just to go a little step further, I absolutely agree with Mr. Reed in his analysis, but I looked at this project and I said, most people do not even know what the zoning variances are. When they buy a property, they see what they see, they like what they like. They don't know what the lot line setbacks are or anything like that, probably. But in this particular case, when you look at the addition or the new building, it's in the same north line as the house itself. And going to the alley, you know, I mean, it's an alley. It's not going to affect anybody there. So I looked at this as a variance. It was very well thought of and deserving. And a lot of it has to do with that they did preserve the original home. They didn't tear it down and build a big box, move it closer to the road, which they could have done. So to me, life is full of trade-offs. And to me, they... And now that they've definitely made the north neighbor happy, I don't see any reason that we should not accept this variance. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming back and taking some of the feedback and especially reaching out to the neighbor, and thank you to the owner for their investment. I know these properties are, you know, a labor of love. I do think that the addition is respectful, and I understand the context of that particular street, that particular neighborhood, so I'm very supportive.
Yeah, thank you. I'll just say that I appreciate that you went and spoke to the neighbor. That's the, you know, one of the most challenging things you could do, and kind of come to consensus is a skill in and of itself. So I applaud you for that. And I just want to say that I think the staff's professional response to the variances was logical and to the point, and that pointed to practical difficulty, and that I am very supportive of this, this proposed as per staff's response.
Thank you, John. Thanks to the applicant for engaging the neighbor. I think that makes all the difference here for us. I'm glad that her voice has been heard here. I also agree with everything Stuart said. I would just keep in mind that these applicants are each individual and handled case by case. I think the decision here shouldn't be interpreted to be a precedent for neighbors, although they can see that this board does have some leniency and some flexibility and some understanding to particular circumstances. Had they respected all their setbacks, this addition might be in the middle of the backyard, and then the homeowner would have no backyard. So I also recognize the effort to preserve that open space as part of the value of the property. And I think that by us giving them some flexibility with the variances, it's good for the homeowner and it's good for the neighborhood. So anyway, would someone like to make a motion?
I'll move it with staff's recommendations.
Okay, and that's for the certificate of appropriateness, Mr. Pascal?
Yes.
Okay, let me call the roll. Ms. Weinstein-Berman?
Yes.
Mr. Stewart? Mr. Reed? Mr. Breslin?
Yes.
Mr. Pascal?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez?
Yes.
Okay, that passes, and we'll need a second motion for the variances.
Move to approve the variances.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay, I'll call the roll. Mr. Breslin?
Yes.
Mr. Reed?
No.
Ms. Weinstein-Berman?
Yes.
Mr. Stewart? Mr. Pascal?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez?
Yes.
Okay. Passes 5-1. Thank you.
We thank you all.
Okay. Is the applicant for 1709 Jefferson ready? Yes. Okay. I didn't see you. There you are. Okay. The next application on the agenda is HPB 220543. This is 1709 Jefferson Avenue. An application has been filed requesting a certificate of appropriateness for the construction of a multifamily residential building on an existing surface parking lot. The subject site is located at the northeast corner of the intersection of 17th Street and Jefferson Avenue. The property is within the RM1 zoning district and is comprised of three platted lots. The site is surrounded, it's a unique site. It is surrounded by the RS4, or single-family zoning district, to the north, an RM2, slightly higher multifamily district, to the east, the CD3, which is a high-intensity commercial district, to the south, and the RM1 zoning district to the west. The applicant is proposing to construct a four-story multifamily residential building on the site, which currently contains 53-space surface parking lot. The residential building will consist of a lobby, a business center, gym, and 24 parking spaces at the ground level, 8 residential units per floor on levels 2 through 4, and private terraces at the roof level for each of the fourth level units. Staff is highly supportive of the application. We believe the existing surface parking lot has had a negative impact on the neighborhood, including the surrounding historic district. The design incorporates, and I'm sure the architect will take you through this in more detail, but it is inspired by and does incorporate several references to the building located at 1688 Meridian. That particular building is not within a local historic district. However, it was designed by Morris Lapidus and does have a lot of significant architectural features. Further, we believe the distribution of architectural forms has resulted in a new building that is compatible with not only the 17th Street, which is a higher intensity corridor, it still respects the existing single-family neighborhood to the north. In this regard, the building has been set back approximately 24 feet at the closest point to its north property line, which is double the required setback. on that side, the required setback would be 12 feet. And the remainder of the building is proposed to be set back approximately 50 feet from the north property line. So they really were sensitive in terms of trying to mass the building so that it would not have an adverse impact on the very low-scale single-family district. Finally, the applicant is seeking a waiver. This is related to the height of the covered parking area at the ground level. The RM1 zoning district does require a 12-foot height above base flood elevation plus 1, which would be 9 in this case, so 12 feet above 9 NGVD. However, the board does have the ability to waive up to 2 feet of that requirement. So that is the waiver. It is not a variance. It does not require review from the variance criteria, but it is a waiver and the ability of the board to allow a 10-foot floor-to-ceiling height above the required base flood plus 1 is in consideration of compatibility. During staff's review, we did believe that we didn't, want to see the building much taller than what is being proposed, and we do believe that it is more compatible with that waiver should the board grant it of the 2 feet. So we are supportive of that and are recommending approval subject to the conditions in your draft order. I am available for any questions if the board members have questions.
Yes, I have a question. It says in, I think you said it as well as in the staff report, that we can waive the height requirement up to 2 feet. Is it just in our sole discretion, or there's anything written in the law about what we should be considering when we grant a waiver?
The waiver would be, if the board determines that the project as proposed with the waiver satisfies the certificate of appropriateness criteria, it's really one of compatibility. If you believe that the project with the waiver would be more compatible than if the waiver was not granted. But it's not a strict criteria. The criteria you would use would be the same as your certificate of appropriateness criteria.
So nothing specific to granting the waiver, just that it would have to be compatible with the surrounding properties as we should consider for just about any aspect of the application.
Correct.
Just to go one step further, if the building was 2 feet higher, would that require a variance, or would that still be within the height?
It potentially could require a variance. The board could allow for up to a 3-foot height variance. So we would have to take a look at it, but it's likely that if they were to comply with that 12 feet, and remember, it's not 12 feet from grade, it's 12 feet from 9, that they may, with their currently designed project, require a variance.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Debbie? No? Okay. Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman, board member, staff. Michael Larkin, Turner South Biscayne Boulevard, here representing the applicant. PJ, could you pull out the presentation, please? So from the applicant, we have owner's representatives, Ophiro Kukerman and David Diaz. They are both appearing via Zoom. Here in chambers are design architects Gustavo Berenblum and Claudia Bush, and our landscape architect, Kiel Simler. Also, Alejandro Moreno is my colleague, just walked in. Good timing, Alejandro. He's passing out packets of materials to you. You all have already received these revised drawings. They're revised in a minor way to address neighbor concerns. Also, their letter of support there, and a one condition for your consideration. So in summary, we're seeking a certificate of approval, certificate of appropriateness for design for a new 24-unit apartment building and a waiver request to provide a 10-floor ground floor clearance where 12 feet is required. Staff is recommending approval of all the requests, and we accept all the conditions set forth in the staff recommendation. With regard to the location of the property, it's situated on the 17th Street corridor on the north side, a block west from where we are right now, and a block I have north from Lincoln Road. The existing use is a surface parking lot. We can certainly do better than that. As you know, that has a heat island effect immediately, and its drainage is antiquated, leading to flooding on the adjacent properties whenever there's a heavy downpour. The property is located within the Palm View Local Historic District. It's at the northeast corner of 17th Street and Jefferson Avenue. As Debbie was describing to you all, the zoning in this neighborhood is a few different things. The southernmost four lots adjacent to 17th Street are zoned RM1. The eastern band is zoned RM2. The interior of this neighborhood is zoned RS4, but interesting enough, back in the 90s and before, it was all zoned RM1. So if you walk this neighborhood, as I did in the past when I lived at Sunshine Towers, which has now been renamed the Leroy, there's ALS within the neighborhood, there are multifamily buildings in the neighborhood, all vestiges and leftovers of its prior RM1 zoning. With regard to short-term rentals, that issue has come up in our discourse with the neighbors. They are prohibited in this neighborhood. We have no intention of doing short-term rentals here. Any lease term will be 6 months and a day. To the south of 17th Street, over 100 feet wide, a large office building, as Debbie described, designed by Morris Lapidus, with a parking lot to the west of that. To the west, you have the Lincoln Marti Day School and a contributing building. To the north, a single-family home owned by Juan Boulevard, who's over there. Juan was gracious enough to invite us into his home. We sat down with him. We went through the drawings, and he is in support of the project. To the east, you have the Montclair condominium. We presented to the Palm View Homeowner Association. We obtained their support. We sat down with Juan. We obtained his support. We presented to the Miami Design Preservation League and earned their support. We also presented to the Montclair. The Montclair has two different issues. One involves the nuisance that could result from a dog run that we previously proposed in the northeast corner of a property, and a loss of privacy. So because Gustavo and Claudia are the good architects that they are, they immediately responded to those requests. And in bullet format, I'm just going to tell you, we eliminated the dog run located in the northeast corner of the property, replaced it with landscaping. We eliminated the dog wash station and the dog park, also in the northeast corner. The reason that they believe that the barking noise of the dogs would constitute a nuisance is that their west elevation has metal on it, and they believe that it would bounce around and reverberate off of that elevation and cause a nuisance. So we are very happy to be good neighbors and remove that type of amenity for our residents. Next, with regard to the loss of privacy, we move the balconies on unit number 7, 15, and 23 slightly to the south. This coincides with an opening between the Montclair buildings instead of facing directly to the Montclair units. We created punch windows with knee walls instead of floor-to-floor windows in all units facing the Montclair to provide further privacy. The balcony on unit number 8, 16, and 24 were shortened by 12 feet, and planters added to the east provide a visual screen to the Montclair. Also, we significantly enhanced the landscaping along our shared property line between our proposed building and the Montclair. We added hedges and tall palms to create a wall of vegetation that will serve as a visual buffer. There has been a concern voiced about the existing trees on the property. Unfortunately, the way that the city code works, they require you to raise your properties. When you raise your properties, you bring in a significant amount of fill. The fill suffocates the root network of the existing trees, so unfortunately it can't remain, but our planting palette is substantial. We brought in so many new trees that I think you all see and can hear testimony from a landscape architect to that effect. I would like it if you all could have these modified drawings that we gave to you and include as Exhibit A in the order today. When we met with MDPL, Daniel raised a concern about he doesn't like fake vegetation, fake landscaping. With regard to the planters, for instance, on the balconies, he doesn't want plastic vines dangling down, and I agree with that. I think that looks tacky, and they don't last. So we're ready to proffer a condition here that says all landscaping must be natural landscaping and not, I think, I don't know if there's a better word than fake, but it won't be fake landscaping, suffice to say. My last point before I turn it over to Gustavo is the design challenge here stems from the 8 variances that were granted to the original developer of the Montclair building back in 2002 by the Board of Adjustment. This makes the Montclair sit within 5 feet of our property line. In spite of this close proximity to our property line, I think our design architects and our landscape architect have stepped up to the plate and have addressed this concern by providing as much privacy as possible to those Montclair unit owners. With that, I'd like to turn over to Gustavo and have him do the remainder of the presentation.
Thank you, Michael, and good morning, members of the board and Mr. Chair. My name is Gustavo Berenblum, principal of Berenblum Bush Architects, with address at 2136 Northwest 8th Avenue. And we are very excited to present this project today. Maybe my voice is taken because we've been working for so long, and so It's a great moment, actually, to show this project and to discuss with you how we came to this design, a design that really straddles history. As you know, every time we do a building, we establish a conversation, a discourse with the past, and establish a foundation for the future. So in this sense, the location of this project is critical because, as Michael was saying, to the north we have the Palm View Historic District with the single-family homes. Just a couple of blocks away here, right, to the west of where we are sitting today. And, of course, we have the civic environment with the convention hall and the city hall. Then moving south, we have the Lapidus building and a block away or two, Lincoln Road. So these are things that we have to consider as we distill the architecture for the project. And the first couple of images I want to show you is to give you a sense of where the site is. As Michael mentioned, it's currently parking, asphalt parking. There are 53 parking spots there, and surrounded by some nice trees. If anything, we want to increase the amount of vegetation and trees. And so in this view and in the next view have given us some cues on how to build up a lush landscape in the site that creates a feeling of wellness when you are inside the project and of fitting with the environment. a good view, actually, of the parking and the Lapidus building that Debbie was mentioning on the right side, and also of the Montclair to the east. And as I said, when we do architecture, we are establishing a conversation with history. And in a way, you can see in this slide that the project site is a crux where things meet. And so how do we resolve that in our project? And our project then takes a lot of cues of the mid-century modern architecture, for example, that you find across the street from the Jeffersonian condo, but also on buildings like the Meridian House that have a U-shaped scheme with courtyards, and then metal treatment on the facade, like the Montclair, and certain colors and treatments for shading, like the Lapidus, and of course, some colors and textures that recall the residential to the north. And so this is something I want you to have in mind, because it really, all of these ideas coalesce in a project that is modern, but we think it really fits the site. It really appropriate to the specific site. When you see the site plan, the access for the parking is actually on Jefferson. It's an existing curb cut, and we are using for the parking access. All the parking is behind a liner of active uses. You have the gym, a business center, and so forth, that actually screens the parking behind. And like Debbie was mentioning too, we have 24 parking spaces, one for each unit, plus one ADA-compliant parking. And we are resolving issues of heights in relation to sustainability and to code compliance, and also to the neighborhood. To the north, you can see that we've established a park and an inside court for the residents, and our building sets back 25 feet. The setback required by code, the minimum setback is 12. We more than double that distance because we thought that the impact on the single-family residents should be lessened as much as possible. And we created this site with a lot of vegetation. And then towards the Montclair on the east, if I go back one slide, we originally had the dog run and the dog park and even a dog washing station, and we removed that in the revise. We increased the landscape, and actually more like a residential single family, creating this kind of area of repose, of quietness, of garden, interior garden conditions that we would want to actually exalt in our project, so that there's not only a buffer but a space where the residents can sit and contemplate and chat and actually increase through this vegetation, the separation with the neighbors. And so there's breeze blocks that we brought in note to the 50s architecture to further separate the neighbor to the north. And then Kiel Samler and his partners, working with landscape architecture, have really created an environment that speaks about these interior gardens. And this is important because we are scaling up the landscape and we are creating this buffer that starts on hedges, goes to trees, and then to palms, as tall as we can to really screen the views to the Montclair and also to the north side. With this revised plan, we've increased it after our conversations and discussions with the Montclair and the neighbors. We've even further increased the natural landscape on the site. This is an original view submitted, and then a revised view with the added vegetation. We also moved some of the balconies to coincide better with the voids between the building on the Montclair.
So, sorry to interrupt. Yes. How many additional minutes would you...
2 minutes. Okay. Thanks. A good section that shows that actually from the north you barely see the building because of this lush vegetation buffer that we've created. And the north elevation in here in this diagram with the position in orange of the existing house, and then how the building, our building, actually sets back further to create an increased separation with this property. And the second floor, in yellow, you see that even the first function of the building is a resident lounge with no balcony overlooking to the north. So, in fact, it's not only 25 feet, but it's more like 40 feet when you are there. The balconies are treated so that vegetation is brought into these apartments and also the views to the outside. When you are in the apartment, the first thing you see is the vegetation, the landscape of these balconies. Every floor has 8 units. And then Michael was mentioning that we tailored, customized the balconies in response to the Montclair, moving them slightly or decreasing them in size to further separate them from the property to the east. A view now from the east elevation, looking to the Montclair, as before shown when we hadn't met with Montclair, and after these discussions, really creating the knee walls that decrease the size of the openings, and then the vegetation with palms, trees, and hedges that will act as a buffer. And in this slide, the scheme of the Morris in blue with the big mass of the Montclair and how we actually appropriately locate it to minimize the impact to the east. And then a couple of slides. The colorations are a nod to the Morris design building. Also the use of bronze. It really established a dialogue. And then this streamlined horizontal that brings back the language of the 50s of mid-century architecture. Last image, one that you have here on the board, an evening rendering with the Lapidus building diagonally and really establishing a language that we think is very appropriate for the area. And with that, we thank you for the opportunity to present. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Gustavo. And Mr. Chairman, I had overlooked when we met with Mr. Bolivar, he was very supportive of the project, but on Friday afternoon, he asked us to modify the height of the wall that's along our shared property line. In the plans, it shows 3-foot retaining wall with landscaping on top of that. He would like it to be 6 foot, so we're happy elevating the wall from 3 feet to 6 feet to address his concern about privacy as well.
Got it. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal.
Of course. Thank you for your presentation.
Chair, can I just ask one question?
Sure.
To the applicant? The height of the wall is along which side?
North.
North. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. If you'll give us a moment, we'll see if the board has any questions for you, and then we'll ask you to come back and address them all. And I guess this might be a good moment to welcome our newest board member here.
Hello.
glad to have you.
Yes, I'd like to welcome Brian Ehrlich. He was appointed by the Mayor and City Commission to fill Nancy Liebman's seat. So welcome, Brian. We're happy to have you aboard.
Thank you very much.
So at this point in the process, they've just made their presentation, and the board has an opportunity to formulate any questions they might have to the applicant. We'll get all those questions out at once and then ask them to respond. We'll go on to public comment, and then we'll have a chance for a board member comment too. So you have,
I have a question for Debbie.
Yes.
Debbie, with the six-foot wall, does that fall within any code that would not require a variance? I thought that the height of a wall between properties was 5 feet.
Seven.
Maybe
they can go up to a maximum of 7 feet on an interior side. So I have no issues with the 6 feet.
Okay, I just wanted that.
The front is 5 feet.
Any other questions for the applicants? Kirk, yes.
A few questions. Going back to what Mr. Larkin referred to in his conversation with Mr. Seraldo, with regard to the planters, you said you're eliminating the plastic planters. Are they being replaced with no planters?
No, let me be more clear. There was never an intention to do fake landscaping. It was always going to be natural, but Daniel, as he's wont to do, wants to hold our feet to the fire and have a condition of the order which mandates that, and we're happy to do that because that was our original intention. The planters will still be there, and they always will going to have natural landscaping.
And they're masonry planters?
What's the material?
Yeah, they're built planters into the balconies like you've, like we've shown here.
Okay. And irrigation is included?
Yes, sir.
For the plants? Okay, there's one question. Two questions with regard to the materials. I love the bronze slatting. I wish you actually had samples because I would have liked to see what the materiality and depth of that was. And the breeze block, I had questions about those two elements. Are they being custom made for this project, or those are existing materials that you're using?
At this point,
we don't see much of that.
Yeah, at this point, we would like to we will probably work with what the industry has to offer, and rather than have customized, because the issue of customized is if in 10 years you have a problem, then you know you have to reinvent the wheel again. So it's better to find something appropriate that is in the market today.
Okay, and then my last question goes to, I guess it touches on disclosures, the letter from Mr. Moreno that we received referring to the tree that's being removed, but there really wasn't much discussion about that tree. So I wanted to ask if you could clarify, right, the two trees. What's the nature? What are those trees, and why are they being removed? And can you just touch on that possibly?
Sure, and we can have our landscape architect, Kiel Simler, also address the board through the chair. But just to directly respond to your question, you know, the city code has requirements that all properties be raised. So you have to bring in tons of fill, and that's in anticipation of the adjacent streets being raised, which here would be 17th Street and Jefferson Avenue. When you bring in fill, it's a good thing. You are raising your property. Your flood risk becomes greatly less. But with regard to existing trees within the property, their root network needs to breathe. And if you're bringing in tons of fill and put it on top of the root network, they can't breathe, and it'll lead to the death of the tree. So we're under an obligation to remove the trees, but in their place, we have a tremendous amount of new trees. I don't know if that answers your question. Would you rather hear from Mr. Simler or?
What kind of, I mean, it's referred to as a hardwood tree. What kind of trees are they being removed?
The two in the northeast corner he's referring to are oaks.
There are two oak trees. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, seeing no other questions, maybe we'll go on to disclosures and public comments. Are there any disclosures to be made?
I had a meeting with both Mr. Larkin and Gustavo on Friday to look at the property, and then afterwards we went to lunch. I paid for my own lunch. Thank you.
Just the emails that we all received from the staff, from neighbors, and...
Okay. And with that, perhaps we can go to public comment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any members of the public wishing to speak on this item, please raise your hand on Zoom or come forward in chambers. Okay, Mr. Chair, we do have one person on Zoom, and it is Tico Almeida.
Yeah, hello. Thank you.
Mr. Almeida, before you address the board, I need to swear you in. Please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you'll be giving in this proceeding is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. Thank you.
Okay, and I'm going to set the clock at 2 minutes.
Great. Thank you to the board for this opportunity to speak on behalf of, or as one of the residents of the neighborhood. I want to talk specifically about the two oak trees that the board member just raised with the developers, and I appreciate the question. I wrote in about this topic. I take the developer at their word that they would like to save the two decades-old 50-foot oak trees, but can't. The question I have, or the point I have in response, is then perhaps they should replace them with two equally tall hardwood trees. They have instead replaced them with tall palm trees. As I understand it, the Miami Beach 2040 Comprehensive Plan has a preference for hardwood over palm, recognizing that it's better for sustainability, better for the environment. It's city policy, as I understand it, to prefer hardwood over palm. And if they're going to cut down two beautiful hardwood oaks that have been there for a long time and that are literally more than 50 feet tall, it strikes me that this board could make a condition that they replace them with equally tall hardwood trees in that same northeast corner. And maybe we meet in the middle. If they're cutting down two 50-foot oaks, at least require them to put up one 50-foot oak in the northeast corner. And in fact, there's the room for it. As they have noted several times in their presentation, there's a 25-foot space that they've created to the north. So I know that an oak tree has a larger circumference of roots than a palm, but they've given themselves 25 feet of space to do it. And there could, and I think should, be a very tall, comparable hardwood tree in the northeast corner. So that is my comment, and I hope the board will take it into account. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Daniel. Welcome back.
Yes, hi, thank you. Daniel Serrato with Miami Design Preservation League. We are supportive of this proposed project. It's very exciting to see all that's been happening in the Palmview neighborhood. I think you'll all remember maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the future of the neighborhood was in question. Property values were down. And the last couple of years, things have really turned around. So I wanted to thank the HOA and the city and all who have worked hard to protect this neighborhood. We did, just to go on about the plants, there's a new project, the Shoma building on Lenox Avenue, that was approved by this board and has about 100 feet of fake vines along its primary facade. We would like to avoid that happening in the future, and that's why we asked that this be proffered into the condition. Just in general, you know, the fake vines kind of take away from the natural architecture. Although we do understand in some cases, like AstroTurf, might be needed where sod won't grow, but overall we'd like to avoid that. We love the connection to Morris Lapidus. We love the use of aluminum, which is a lot more resilient than stainless steel. And as far as the trees, one thought that we just had was, what if we move the trees into Pride Park, like they did with the Convention Center hotel trees? So if Michael is open, if his clients are open to the city taking the trees, maybe he could let us know, and we'll go get to work upstairs. So thank you very much for all your help.
Okay, any other members of the public wishing to comment? See none, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Unless the applicant would like to address anything, we would go on.
So in reference to what Mr. Serraldo just said, yes, we could make these trees available to the city for transport at the city's cost to the new Pride Park, which is just north of here.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, on to board member comment. Would anyone, Stuart?
Yes, thank you. So I was looking at the planting plan, given, I guess this is the revised planting plan that was prepared in response to the neighbor's comments, the LA 3.01 that was given us today. And it has gumbo limbo in there, which is a hardwood tree, and it's very fast growing. It sort of grows almost like a space alien sometimes. It's, you know, you come back and, wow, how did that tree grow so fast? And many, many years ago, I was a pollution control inspector for Dade County Department of Environmental Resource Management. And one of the codes that I enforced frequently was removing specimen trees without a permit. So I'm not saying that these specimen trees, the oaks, are of a, it depends on the size of them, and I have no idea what the current code is of the county and what the requirements are. But there might be a requirement that these oak trees are of a size where they would need to get a permit to remove them. And I think it's a great suggestion to move them, but there might be practical difficulties with removing the oak trees. I don't know about the space in there or the soils. I'm not an expert on moving trees, but if they could be saved and moved, that's great. Kurt brought up the issue of whether or not there's going to be irrigation for the plants. Fortunately, the palette of plants they have there on their landscaping plan are mostly natives. So once the roots establish, they're good to go, and they just live off of the natural rainfall. And I think it's really interesting how we're now discussing the landscaping, because as far as the design goes, I don't think we've seen many applications where they've given so much consideration into the surrounding structures, the surrounding neighborhoods, and the fact that it's a mix of uses, commercial and single family and multi, and to the extent that they went to satisfy their neighbors. I think that we couldn't have gotten a more sensitive plan because of the way they went into it. And I just personally think that since the concern is about the landscaping plan, that this is going to be almost like a neighborhood botanical garden with what they're using there. Thank you.
First off, I'd like to thank you guys for doing an absolutely spectacular project, not asking for any variances or anything, a minor little waiver. And I also want to commend you for the due diligence that you've done with the Montclair, because what Mr. Reed might not realize is they got a variance to build within 5 feet of the lot line, and now they're all upset that a building's being built behind them. And you've widened your the amount of distance you've had to have. You've done overplanting. You've moved balconies. You've done all these things for a building that really shouldn't be complaining that they're closer to the lot line than they should be. So I think you've done an amazing job, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. Well, good morning. And I just want to say this is, you know, in 6 years, 7 years now, 8 years, now going maybe 7 years on the board, in my seventh year, I just haven't seen a project that's kind of this sensitive on so many different levels. Like you dig into this project and you dig into the details and you start to understand, how the plants are watered, how this project works. You dig into the life that you're planning for people who live in this building. And it's amazing. You've thought about how people live, how they'll be, you know, productive citizens of Miami Beach, and this building will be supporting their efforts. And also, I have to applaud you and your team for the work you've done with the neighbors, because this is really a model for going around to the neighbors and understanding. I was only going to wonder if there maybe could be two oak trees planted as young oak trees, maybe not huge, but young oak trees that could then grow into their 50-year-old ancestors later somewhere on the site to kind of memorialize that loss which I also feel.
Absolutely. And we'll plant them as big as we can feasibly get them in there, and then they're commercially available, of course.
Okay. That would be. I think that would be wonderful. It wasn't a requirement, but it was just a suggestion. But I applaud you. It's really a beautiful project.
Thank you.
And relates to the bronze, everything is really incredible. Thank you.
Thank you again so much. I echo everyone. It's a stunning project. Very excited to see it and share your enthusiasm. Thank you.
Thank you. So, I mean, I echo the opinion that I think it's beautifully designed. It fits so perfectly in with the neighborhood, the design, the horizontality, the materials, I think, are really, really nicely done. I think the scale is fantastic. It's beautiful. And I appreciate all the work that went into it. Two issues where I'm stuck. I'm stuck on the oak trees. It's not really very resilient friendly, the idea of removing mature oak trees. I think the plant list, the inventory that you proposed is nice, and there are a good deal of natives included on there, none of which provide the same sort of shade coverage, the same sort of sustenance for life and epiphytes and all of that other kind of thing that goes into, a native landscape. I just don't feel like it's been fully explained to me why these two trees can't be pruned appropriately. I know you can't just shock the tree and cut the heck out of it, but pruned and saved if they are decades old trees. I'm surprised that our city would allow those sort of assets to be removed. Has nothing to do with the design of the building. I feel like, if we're moving beneficial trees off of private properties and into the parks, I don't think that's a great model. I think if that's the only way of saving those two trees, then so be it. But within the application itself, the case hasn't been made of why these trees are not viable, why they couldn't be, if they could be moved to a park. You're talking about, and you did mention this, I was listening about raising the soil, then if the trees could be moved to a park, then why couldn't the trees be lifted to fit within the elevated soil? There's just questions on that, one. Two, I'm just going to make the case here because I feel it needs to be made. Sorry for the dogs. Because there's a lot of dogs that live in our city. There's a lot of dog owners. People complain about dogs making a mess on the streets, dogs doing this, that, and the other thing. When the owners of condos or dwellers within a particular building have dogs and they have resources for their dogs to be tended to, they're able to, for instance, do DNA tests to ensure the dogs aren't pooping everywhere. And dogs that are, in my experience, and I've always had dogs, that are actually tended to, are not the ones that are barking. It's the dogs that are neglected. And so I understand that the neighbors came in with their concerns about that, but I don't think that's a great move on the city's part. To take this approach that having dogs anywhere around is a nuisance because people love dogs and they're an engaged part of our city. So I just have to make that one statement because I think it's important. I think it's really true. If you don't want dogs sort of living a life like cockroaches, clambering around on the streets and pooping on sidewalks, you have to give them and their owners a place to go. And I think that was originally a nice feature of this building. And that's it. I mean, nothing I could complain about with regard to the design, everything about it, the amenities you're providing, the way you're concealing the parking but providing it,
All sorts of fantastic, really, really couldn't have been better, I think, design components of this building. I'm just, again, I don't feel the case has been made with regard to the trees. If there's any more insights from the urban forester that's gone into that, it would make me feel a lot better condemning these two oaks that I don't know the age of them because it's not really stated here. If they're 50-year-old oaks, then obviously they're not going to be able to be replaced in a short amount of time. I think it's relevant. So, but thank you for this. I think could not have been designed more compatibly and more in celebration of the existing built structure of that beautiful historic neighborhood. So thank you.
Thanks, Kirk. I concur with everybody here. This is a model project for the city. So congratulations. And some of the things that I think are most valuable are showing us what a future Miami Beach can look like, with elevated structures, little by little, building up the city, and we do it one piece at a time. And this does it in a very reasonable way. Even that the whole parking area, I see you slope up to, a couple feet, and then continue up from there. The fact that you've included outdoor circulation, I think is very appropriate and very good. No need to air condition, all of that, and the active liner, it's just the right thing to do. We see a lot of projects here that are proposed with landscape features on the exterior of the building. I often worry what's going to happen when the maintenance falls off, as it may do over time, and we're left with a blank wall. In this case, the concrete trellis is an architectural feature that, whether the landscape is there, and hopefully it is, but maybe 10 or 20 years from now, it's in different hands, it's a different scenario. I think that the concrete trellis still is, helping to shade the building and embellish the architecture. So, of course, we're excited to see them green, but even in the case that they're not, I think that's all really good. I did actually, looking more closely here, wonder about the roof terraces, the private terraces, which look like they're partially enclosed but not completely. Are the private residents able to move from one to the other, or are they
each
content?
One is individual for the unit, and they have just a trellis. And if I may address the comment that you had about the planters, because really for us, it is about creating this proximity to landscape, right? That brings in the concept of well-being. You will have plants inside your unit, probably, then in the planters, and then farther away. So there is a gradation of relationship to landscape that I think has a lot to do today with, creating spaces that are more welcoming for those residents. And so it's intrinsically, it's essential to the project. It's not a decorative thing here that we are attaching to a facade. And so we hope that kind of incentivizes whoever is living there to understand this relationship, the goodness of having landscape, and then, helping maintain this in the future.
Well, I can certainly appreciate that. And I leave it to the building to work out, how that is maintained and managed. It just so happens that these buildings tend to outlive their original owners, mm-hmm. outlive us, and 50 years from now, what's that going to be like? So what my point was that it doesn't, while it's a great amenity, I don't think the building leans on it. I don't think it's dependent on it like other projects that we've seen. So anyway, kudos to the design team.
Thank you.
So final comment.
Yeah, I want to go further on what Mr. Pascal said. When I first heard that they were taking the dog park out, I said, this is private property. They didn't even have to show us that in their plan. Mm. They could do that later. Mm. And they said, okay, well, we'll take it out. And I honestly don't know why it was even in the plan to start with. They could just go do it afterwards and everybody would be happy. I'm perfectly happy to see the dog park back in the plan. It's on their property. It has nothing to do with the building itself. The landscaping is all there. And I was sorry to see it come out. So I would mention that since Mr. Pascal brought it up.
Okay. Would someone like to make a motion?
Okay, I guess we can take a second, and then I think we need a little bit of housekeeping for the HPB the draft order with some of the proffers and then the additional plans.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Okay.
Okay, now.
So the applicant did pass out what we're putting into the record as Exhibit A. I don't know. Did you give Mr. Ehrlich Exhibit A?
Don't think we had his email address, so.
Do you have a hard copy?
Oh, all right, for a hard copy.
And Exhibit A incorporates changes along the north and east sides of the property. Mm-hmm. Those were the items that Mr. Larkin went through earlier. Changes to the landscaping, an increase in landscaping, and for the building, a reduction in balcony and other projections. So I guess my question is, would you like to incorporate the maker of the motion, Exhibit A, into the order as the design for the north and east portions of the property shall be consistent with Exhibit A?
The plans given today.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay, so that would be the design of the north and east portions of the project shall be consistent with Exhibit A, which is dated February 10th, 2022. The other proffer I heard from the applicant was that they were going to proffer that all landscaping for the project be natural material and that the artificial landscape will not be incorporated into the project.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And then the last proffer I heard was that the property wall along the north side of the project shall be increased to 6 feet in height.
Correct. And then two more, Debbie, that will make these oak trees available to the city if the city should choose to take them to Pride Park or wherever they like. And John had asked that we do two new oak trees in the place of the oak trees being removed, and we agree to that as well.
And will you be paying for the removal and the delivery of those trees?
No, that'll be at the city cost.
I would rather not put that in the order because there's the city would have to accept that, and then they would not be part of this particular property, but they'd be moved somewhere else. I think that is a generous proffer to donate these trees if the city would like to go to the expense to relocate them. But I would rather keep that out of this particular order, and okay. We'll take that as a good faith effort. And the city will be reaching out to you if they have an interest in doing so. But the additional landscape condition was that two oak trees shall be incorporated into the landscape plan.
Correct.
On the north side.
On the north side.
Can there be at least a stipulation of how big they're going to be? They're not going to be 1 gallons.
No. It could be 25 feet in height at time of planting.
Okay. Thank
which
you.
Is big, in another word.
Okay, so does the maker of the motion accept those conditions, and we're going to incorporate approximately 25-foot height for the oaks?
At time of planting, right?
At time of planting.
Yes.
Okay, and let's call the roll. There is no variances, so we're just doing one motion to approve.
But we got to know if the second still holds.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
Okay.
No, we
and the waiver is incorporated into the motion for the certificate of appropriateness. Let me call the roll. Mr. Breslin?
Yes.
Ms. Weinstein-Berman?
Yes.
Mr. Ehrlich?
Yes.
Mr. Pascal?
Yes.
Mr. Reed?
Yes.
Mr. Stewart?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you for perfect presentation.
We'll invite you to the opening.
Great.
The last regular item is HPB 22-0555, 1052 Ocean Drive. An application has been filed requesting a certificate of appropriateness for facade modifications and a suspended canopy system. The subject building was originally constructed in 1950 as a two-story apartment building, and in 2007 an attached four-story addition was constructed. The majority of the ground level of the building is occupied by the applicant, the Palace Bar and Restaurant, who is requesting three modifications to the exterior of the building. The first modification proposed is to reconfigure the three easternmost ground level window openings along the south facade of the two-story portion of the building. Within each of the three openings, the existing swing door and three panel fixed storefronts are proposed to be replaced with a four panel sliding glass door system. This modification will require the demolition of the approximately 6-inch tall curb located below the existing windows. Staff has no objection to this modification as it will be minimally, if at all, perceivable from Ocean Drive and maintains the existing four-division configuration within each opening. The second modification is to replace the existing swing and collapsible door system located at the ground level east facade of the four-story addition with glass garage-style doors. Staff has no objection to this modification as the proposed design will function in a similar manner to the existing configuration and will not have any adverse impact on the original design of the addition. Finally, within the courtyard space, the applicant is proposing to retain an existing clear vinyl canopy, which staff has no objection to and could be easily removed in the future. With that, staff is recommending approval of the application.
Okay, anyone on the board have questions for staff at this time?
I walked by this last night, and I'm wondering why do we have to give permission for them to keep the clear canopy that they already have? I mean, why is that part of this?
Well, there's two reasons why there's part of it. Number one, they installed it without prior approval. Number two, this particular property is governed by a conditional use permit that was approved by the planning board, and the planning board order for the CUP has a condition that requires review by the Historic Preservation Board. It's minimally visible from the right-of-way, which is probably why this wasn't caught earlier. But we wanted to clean everything up, and we advised the applicant to also request that so that they're compliant with all of the city regulations.
Thank you for the...
Okay, with that, we invite the applicant to make the presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Honorable Board Members. James Rao with Greenspoon Martyr, office at 600 Brickell Avenue. Here with me today on Zoom are my associate, Adrian Noto, our project architect, Jennifer McConaughey, and our client, Tom Donnell, who's here right behind me in the front seat, the very passionate owner and operator of the Palace. As Jake explained, this is an application for a certificate of appropriateness for some relatively minor modifications to essentially beautify the building and make it more functional for the operation of the business and to accommodate patrons, as Mr. Breslin pointed out, something like a canopy to keep rain out becomes essential. Your staff report recommends approval, and the applicant's in agreement with all of the conditions that are recommended. It also noted the MDPL support for the project in their published report. At this time, I was going to allow the project architect just to run you through what the request is. Jennifer's on Zoom, and I'll just step over to the presentation portion and ask if PJ could put that up. I don't know. Can we do that at the same time that Jennifer is
speaking? I see Jennifer with her hand raised. Jennifer, have you been sworn in?
I have not been sworn in.
Jennifer, please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you'll be giving in this proceeding is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Jen, I don't know if you can see the presentation, but sure. We have the front page up. Yes. If you want to just let me know what you want to explain through, and I can go to that page.
Yeah, absolutely. You can keep, go to the next page, please. Sorry, it's not actually letting me see the screen.
Okay, you can just tell me what page you want.
Here we go. Got it. Okay, I see now. Let's go to page A101, which should be page 8.
Okay.
There we go. Yes, thank you. So there's really dealing with the storefronts here. On the north side, there's a building that was built in the 1950s. That's 1052 Ocean. And the first three, we call them the zigzag panels, we are proposing to remove the fixed storefront and door that's in each one of those panels, and remove the curb that sits below that and replace it with a four-panel wide sliding door, which just makes access to the exterior easier. It just makes the inside a lot nicer place to be while there's shows going on. And then on the south side, which faces east, Ocean Drive, that building was built in, I believe, 2004, 2005. And right now there are stack and fold doors that really are a mess. They didn't last very long. There's a lot of water intrusion. So Tom would like is really to have something that operates in a similar way, but would last a lot longer and look much better and nicer for the area. And so next, we can maybe scroll through some more images. Next page. So you'll see here on the elevation that on the right side, that's the 1952 building. We are not proposing to modify anything facing Ocean Drive. And then on the left side is the building built in 2005. Those doors are set back at least probably about 20, 30 feet from the street. So there's seating in front of that. So, the garage doors are not that prominent. Next slide. There you see, those are the three doors that are affected. And the proposed is on the bottom. So very similar situation. Next slide. And there's some just kind of mood images of what the garage, what the overhead door panels will look like. Next slide. And here's a rendering of the 2004 building. You see that these doors are set very far back. The proposed doors are below. They're actually missing two columns there in the rendering. So it's not one big door, it's three doors. But this was really just a mood image to kind of show everybody what it's going to look like. And that's it. It's a very simple request.
With that, we're here to answer any questions you may have. Tom is here. Jennifer's here. We're here. Anything you may have questions on.
Thank you for the presentation. Does the board have any questions to put forth? And if so, we'll just ask to let us all get them all out, and we'll ask you to respond to them together. Yeah, Brian?
Just a question on the canopy that we mentioned that had been done previously. On the ask on that is only that it remain. Is that correct?
We're going to, let him respond to all of our questions together. Oh, okay. So we'll just take a note and we'll get his answer in a minute. Any other questions? I was also going to ask about that. I don't see any drawing details here for that canopy. I'm not sure really what we're looking at. And so I think it's kind of hard to approve something that's not presented here. I mean, I saw it there's one picture and there's a single line in the elevation, but I guess that would be another question for the applicant. So anybody else have questions? No? Okay. Then that's it. If you would like to come back and address Kirk has one.
Well, I'm not really seeing a good representation. I don't know if I'm missing it, of the north side of the Tony Sherman building, the storefronts.
Am I
I'm missing an image of that. Or maybe
it's on the elevation.
There's not a photograph, though, correct?
I believe there's a photo on A0.05 at the top right.
Thank you, Jake. Yeah, it just wasn't delineated between buildings, so it was a little hard to follow. I appreciate that.
Okay. And just to answer Mr. Oler's question, yes, there's no intention to do anything different. It's just what's in the picture. Other comments? I think maybe since it's clear, the applicant didn't realize that it needed any particular type of approval. It's just a clear cover to keep the rain out, fairly small.
And what is that material?
It's a heavy plastic. Like a clear vinyl, heavy plastic. Which, as the staff indicated, can be taken down in the future if necessary. It's not like a permanent structure or anything.
Okay. Thank you. With that, perhaps we'll do disclosures. Does anyone have anything to disclose at this time for this project? No. Okay. Seeing none, Debbie, perhaps we can move on to public comment.
Absolutely. So any members in the audience wishing to come forward, please do so. Any members on Zoom, please raise your hand. Okay, I see no members on Zoom.
Yes, hi, Daniel Serralda with Miami Design Preservation League. We are supportive of the project according to staff recommendations. One question, though, I did have in seeing the presentation is I was there a few months ago, and the AC, like the doors are wide open, and then the AC at the bar where I was sitting was like dripping, so they had like a cup of water to collect it. I'm just wondering, maybe the architect could let us know, with additional opening and having it totally open, is there also a plan with the AC to deal with that so that the visitor experience remains optimal? Thank you.
Room looks rather empty. What about Zoom?
That's something we could look at.
I see no members on Zoom.
Okay. So would the applicant like to respond to that?
Just to help out the board and the question, Tom just mentioned to me that the AC had a clog in it that particular day, which has been cleared out. So apparently it was that day.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. So we'll go on to board comments. Anybody like to jump in? The board is quiet this morning. Oh, Kirk. We can always count on Kirk first.
I'll jump in. I'm supportive of the project. I think it's interesting that this Kobe Karp structure has been before us many, many times. I also think it's incredibly frustrating how many times I hear that building referred to as a MIMO structure. Yeah, I mean, it's had a lot of alterations that have gone through this board. It's not a contributing structure, and I'm supportive of it being actively used. I also want to call out the Tony Sherman structure, because I think it's an excellent structure. I'm grateful that the Ocean Drive facade is being maintained. I kind of gasp every time I drive through Fort Lauderdale. I think it's a Jolly Roger. Is the structure that he designed in Fort Lauderdale, which is fantastic, but it's not being maintained in the same way that Miami Beach and the owners of this structure are maintaining that Tony Sherman structure, which is festive and nautical and awesome. I don't feel that any, as staff referenced, that any of the alterations to the Tony Sherman structure detract and they're all reversible, and so I'm 100% supportive. I think it's great to see these structures continue to have a vibrant life, and so I'm 100% supportive of this with staff's recommendations.
Thank you, Kirk. Anyone else? No?
I mean, if no one has anything else to add, I'm happy to move a motion.
I'll just add one thing. You know, with regard to, I mean, the doors are perfectly appropriate. I think the canopy structure, you know, normally we see, you know, details of, you know, the material, its attachments, where's the water going. You know, it looks like it's collecting a lot of water. In the one photo I see here, it looks like it's going to a gutter. There's a leader. I'm not sure where that's going. I'm not sure if there are any water issues when you get heavy rains there. But I think it's hard to approve that without seeing some more technical drawings of it.
So in general, staff does have the authority under the city code to review awnings and canopy structures administratively. And we typically require those details at the permit phase, the building permit phase. I don't believe this canopy has a building permit or has city approval. So we will be, at a staff level, reviewing those details at that time. And you know, awnings and canopies are something that we, you know, consistently review and approve at the administrative level. The code does give us that authority, so I'm confident that we can work out those final details. It will have to also be reviewed by the fire department in terms of the materiality of it, so that it complies with all, not only historic preservation requirements, but building and fire requirements.
So does that not need to be stated within the approval?
I think we have a general condition that the final details of the exterior improvements be reviewed at a staff level. Let me look at the draft order. We could add one for the canopy, for the suspended awning slash canopy system. Right now we have one for the proposed door systems, but we could add a condition that the final design and details of that structure be reviewed by staff prior to the issuance of a permit. Okay, so that would be, I know we had a motion.
I'll move it with that condition added.
Okay, with that condition regarding that final design and details of the proposed suspended canopy system be reviewed by staff. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, second by Mr. Ehrlich. Let me call the roll. Mr. Reed?
Yes.
Mr. Breslin?
Yes.
Ms. Weinstein-Berman?
Yes.
Mr. Stewart? Mr. Pascal?
Yes.
Mr. Ehrlich?
Yes.
Mr. Lopez?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes the regular applications. We do have one discussion item on the agenda with regard to the possible placement of a proposed State of Florida historical marker that would be honoring Desi Arnaz. So what I provided you was the City Commission memorandum. This is going, I believe it's on the February 22nd agenda. It was originally scheduled to be heard by the City Commission February 1st. Due to the length of their agenda, however, they did not get to it. But I thought it was important, since the proposed location is within the Museum Historic District, for this board to discuss the item and make any recommendations that you may have. We have done some outreach to the Miami City Ballet, the Bass Museum. This was also presented to the Hispanic Affairs Committee. And I did discuss this with Mr. Breslin in relation to the Collins Park Neighborhood Association. What's really interesting, I provided some brief background in this memo regarding Mr. Arnaz's life. He did spend an incredible amount of time in the city of Miami Beach, especially as a youth, and obviously went on to really exceptional endeavors in entertainment and business. So we are supportive of that. This was spearheaded by an outside individual. Mr. Gary McKinney did approach the one of the commissioners who sponsored this item as something that the city would be doing. This is the text of the marker, which is on page 2 of the commission memorandum, was reviewed by the state of Florida. What's interesting to note is, and I need to thank Jeff Donnelly for invaluable information that he provided, in Mr. Arnaz's autobiography, he states that he performed at the Park Central Hotel, which is where he made popular the conga dance. Because of some information that Mr. Donnelly provided us, staff was able to perform some research and has come to the conclusion, indisputably, that the Mr. Arnaz's performances and his what was later to be known as the La Conga nightclub was actually not the Park Central Hotel, but was part of the Park Central, the Park Avenue restaurant, which was on where the Miami City Ballet is located today. Therefore, we did discuss this with the state. The state agreed to amend the language, and that is why we have chosen, at this point, two possible locations. And I provided a map for you all. The exact location of the La Conga nightclub, where Desi Arnaz and his orchestra performed, was actually at the corner of Park Avenue and 22nd Street. So that's at the bottom of the photograph where the Miami City Ballet is today. We evaluated that particular location. The sidewalks are very narrow. There's not adequate room, in staff's opinion, to put one of those pole sign historical markers. So we did identify immediately across the street at the corner where the Bass Museum property is that's a potential location, which we believe would be the closest we could get without interfering with pedestrian safety and circulation. Alternatively, we have also identified the pedestrian plaza along Liberty Avenue, which in our opinion will get more visibility, more pedestrian traffic, and likely have more public appreciation in that particular location. So that is our first preference. Either location would still be required to be approved by the state of Florida, which is why we kind of have two, right? Because if the state is not going to approve our preference, which would be the Liberty Pedestrian Plaza, then we have an alternate location at the corner of Park and 22nd. Ultimately, this is going to be located either within city property or city right-of-way and needs the City Commission's authorization for this. So that's what we will be doing on February 22nd, hopefully, if this item is brought up. And just wanted to advise the board and get any opinions or recommendations you have.
Okay, I probably know more about that area than most people. First off, the City Commission has yet to even name the plaza between Miami City Ballet and the library, even though Collins Park Neighborhood Association has asked twice to at least give it a name. Some people call it the Collins Plaza, Collins Park Plaza. Some people call it the Liberty Plaza. You know, maybe it's going to be the Desi Arnaz Plaza. I mean, I don't know. The fact is it does not have a name currently. And I think that part of whatever we sent to the commission now, it should be, hello, let's finally name this plaza something. They came back to me initially saying, well, we should sell the naming rights. Okay, well, that would be your job to sell the naming rights, not our job. And they go to Starwood and say, let's call it Starwood Plaza. I mean, I really don't care, but it needs to have a name. And second, just for anybody else, right across the street from the Congo Lounge was the Bill Jordan House of Jazz, which is now a vacant lot, and I believe there's a proposal coming before us soon to actually build a restaurant there. So I think the plaza location is absolutely the best place to place it, and I think that the final placement of exactly where within that plaza should be coordinated with Miami City Ballet. I'm pretty open to where it goes as long as they're happy. And that's all I can say. Thank you.
Go ahead. Were you going to jump in?
Yeah, I was just a point of clarification. I'm not too familiar with markers, or perhaps I am, but I'm just not quite aware. Are we talking about the plaques that actually they're embedded into, well, just tell me how actually that works. Sorry.
Definitely. I apologize for not including
the photograph. There's no visual, so it's hard for me.
Yeah, the state of Florida does have a marker program, so these are standard markers. They're quite large. The plaque itself is about 3 feet by 4 feet, maybe slightly smaller, but I think it's 42 inches by maybe 36 inches. And traditionally, they come on a pole. There's at the 400 block of Lincoln Road that the city installed relatively recently, and they're on a post, and then the top of the marker, once the post is installed, is probably about 6 feet or 7 feet tall total with the post and the plaque. So they're quite large, which is somewhat of one of the challenges for finding the exact location, but that's a very good point. They're very unique. We can't deviate from the design of the standard state plaque.
I just wanted to add that I think this is a really wonderful thing to highlight this important figure in Miami Beach history, particularly because the accomplishments of an immigrant. And I think that the location of it should be in its most prominent potential location, which I think is on that plaza, which is nameless at the moment. So anyway, just thought I'd add that.
Mr. Chair, we do have a member of the public on Zoom that has their hand raised. Can we hear a comment? Mitch Novick. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, everybody. Good late morning and Happy New Year. I spoke last month. Regarding Desi Arnaz, I was taught nearly 35 years ago that not the conga, but the rumba craze began on Espanola Way. I'm wondering if Seth has any insight if whether that's factual. And moreover, Desi Arnaz was a known womanizer who was quoted as saying, marriage is nice, but adultery is a lot more fun. So either way, I do support this marker, but I have some concern and reservations that he may have been more influential in the Espanola Way part of town. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
The only thing I was going to, I don't know if they still have matching grants or grants for these markers, but I have been successful in getting grants previously. It's a small amount, perhaps not worth the paperwork that goes along with it, but just something for the commission to look into.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And the planning department does have a fund. It is part of our work plan to get more of these for historic sites. We have a list of sites that we want to install these. Again, we started this several years ago, and we do have, I think we have four that prior to COVID were installed. And hopefully we'll get back on that. But the good news is that I think in terms of the budget, at this point, we have that money allocated. Mr. McKinney, who spearheaded this effort, has also had a GoFundMe page and has offered to donate his proceeds, which I think are about $700 or $800, as part of this effort. That would also be required to be accepted by the city commission, and we're going to hopefully be taking that through the process.
Can I jump in? No, I think this is fantastic. We, as a historical preservation board, to highlight the history of important residents and people who contribute a lot to American culture and music. And I think this is a very important action today. And I would hope that we'd have, this would start seeking plaques for, like, the Beatles played here. I can't believe we don't have any statues or plaques for the Beatles. And there's probably so many examples. And I didn't know that he developed the conga dance. I always thought it was sort of like dating, like someone's after you, you're after someone else. So I think it's cool that he called it himself the Dance of Desperation.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Gary was part of our Save the Deauville initiative that, you know, unfortunately we weren't able to save the Deauville, but it's great that he brought this idea forward. And on what Stuart was saying, that there's been so many musicians inspired by Miami Beach or who recorded here. So I think it's a great idea to start recognizing them as well. So thank you all for what you're doing.
So are you asking for a letter of recommendation?
I don't know if we need anything formal, but if you want to, it sounds like the consensus of the board is for the preferred location to be in the Collins Park Plaza, which we also want a name.
I have a name suggestion. Since we're looking at Liberty Avenue and he was an immigrant, why not just something like Liberty Plaza and we're a Spanish
That's
name, Plaza de Libertad?
That's what I originally asked for from the commission. I said, it's Liberty Avenue. We closed off. Let's call it Liberty Plaza. No, that's just such a simple name and blah, blah, blah.
There's already statues there to...
I mean, for years I've been calling it the Liberty Plaza.
So, and I do, too, because it doesn't have a name.
I guess it needs a formal name, and we can transmit that recommendation to the commission if there's a consensus on the board that we want a formal name for the plaza at the intersection of 22nd Street and Liberty Avenue.
And the other thing with the now with QR codes, I mean, we have several signs through Collins Park neighborhood and in the Botanical Garden that tell you a little bit, but then you've got a QR code that gives you a lot more information and in multiple languages. This might be something the state might want to consider doing on these plaques in the future. So you're not just reading a few words and say, oh, that's nice. If you're really interested, you can click on it and find a lot more information.
Videos, here is music, watch them dance.
So that might be a suggestion that we, you know, pass on. I mean, there's always room to make change to modernize.
I'll add one more thing, which is in anticipation of a future row of these signs celebrating the many musicians, which, you know, one in by itself is okay, but you start to see a crowd of these, it's not quite so nice. But I'm reminded of the choragic monuments outside of the, at the base of the Acropolis in ancient Athens. They would recognize their greatest singers, musicians, actors, with commemorative statues that would line the streets and embellish the streets, which I think is a more tasteful way of commemorating someone than just lining up one plaque after another. And you could still have a QR code on the base, on the pedestal or something. So that might be an upgrade to suggest.
What's the value, besides having a plaque and it being recognizable and, oh, it's got the state of Florida... It's a stamp of approval on it. But what, I mean, does it really add any value that we wouldn't get for following, like, Rick's suggestion, having an actual work of art, like a statue, a bust? Not that there's anything wrong with a plaque from the state of Florida, and that's what we're considering today, and I'm all in favor of it. But, why not go all out for somebody like Desi Arnaz?
Somebody has to pay for it.
I just thought of this in regard to what Rick was just saying, but also with regard to the North Beach tripod we talked about a while ago. And for something like that, I know that Art in Public Places are always trying to come up with ideas and seem to be well-funded, especially when the city is prosperous in terms of construction, which it seems to be right now. Is there not any possible opportunity of a collaboration between this board on certain things and Art in Public Places, or do they just... Is that a possibility as a funding source for some of these ideas?
There's definitely opportunity for collaboration. There's actually a requirement. So we have the city has an Art in Public Places program, which has certain requirements. Any city project requires a certain percentage of that budget to go toward public art. And any Art in Public Places project would require a recommendation from this board. So you do see art. You saw the most recent one, I think, was at the convention center. I think you saw the humanoids along Collins Canal and the mural that's painted on the wall of the convention center within the new addition. That was the corner where the new addition was. But certainly, and I think Brian, is familiar with the process to a certain extent. We didn't really get a proper introduction to Mr. Ehrlich, but he did sit on the Cultural Affairs Council,
Cultural Arts Council.
And so he probably, could speak more eloquently than I am. But I know we have a great relationship with Brandy Reddick, who runs the program. And so, you as a historic preservation board have a recommending advisory capacity where you can make recommendations, but any formal AIPP projects in the historic districts would come before you as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would just to kind of tout the excellence of that board, I do think that, making our opinions known to those boards would be quite helpful because they are often looking for kind of collaborative ways to work with what they have, existing structures, that kind of a thing. So if we have ideas, it's probably best that we elucidate them and pass them on to them. So they're quite responsive.
Could I mention one thing about the tower that since it is Kirk's last meeting, just so you're all aware that MDPL, we did let the commission know that we also support moving the tower into public hands, and I'm actually meeting with the owners on Friday. I know that Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez has an item on the neighborhood's agenda to discuss that because it would require some funding. So hopefully we will be able to save that tower, and if you have ideas of where to move it, we're happy to hear. We were thinking maybe in a park near the band shell or somewhere nearby. So thank you.
Debbie, it is interesting that you said the last thing that's come before us was the humanoids and whatnot around the convention center. The city has built buildings since then, like the Collins Park Garage, and they're getting ready to build the artist workforce housing. It seems to me like there should be some money there to do some more public art, and we should ask them about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to reach out to Brandy and ask her what's in the works and what the plan is, and I can report back at our next meeting.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is that sufficient input on that topic?
Yeah, for the Desi Arnaz, I think by acclamation, the board is supportive and has a preferred location of the Collins Park Plaza and would also like separately to request that the City Commission begin the formal naming process for the plaza.
I have one other thing I'd like to bring up to the board and to you, Debbie. I have not seen any plans come to this board for the Traymore Hotel, but yet they're doing major demolition. They've taken out windows. There's plywood up there and everything else, and we have seen nothing. And those windows were all replaced when it was done, what, 10 years ago? And, you know, they're all out, and I see plywood up there now. And
we can look into that. I am not familiar with any application that has been submitted or is in the queue for this
2445 Collins Avenue.
I did meet with the property owner many months ago to discuss some improvements they were looking to make, but again, nothing has been submitted to the planning department for
consideration. So they could be
doing
demolition without a permit.
I'll look into it. I would, you know, optimistically assume they have a building permit for a window replacement, but I can confirm that at the next meeting. Absolutely. Yeah, it's an important building, and it was beautifully restored, you know, less than a decade ago, I think. So it's definitely, I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
I had one more item or one more thing to talk about. While today was a very short agenda, it's not even noon, it's quiet and peaceful, right? You get the false impression that, you know, everything's cool in Miami Beach, but we know that there are many buildings under threat, and we've talked a lot about the single-family homes ongoing issue, and we have also talked about making recommendations to the City Commission about being proactive in designating historic structures. I know that there's a limitation, though, with single-family homes. But I just wanted to mention this again, that how important it is for the city to increase the capacity of the preservation office here at the city. I know that it's hard work, and, you know, we see it. We recently saw an issue in Coral Gables where, you know, there was sudden outrage because the developer was going to do something. Well, you know, it's too late when the developer's ready to go and the rules aren't in place to protect something. That's not the time. It's when we have to get in front of it as much as possible. And I think we've been behind it a little bit lately. And so, you know, I asked MDPL, but I'm sure, you know, nodding and agrees. And I don't know what more we can do to encourage the city to put more resources into proactively protecting structures that may be threatened.
Well, I can give you a bit of an update with regard to the single-family homes. As you know, in previous, and Brian, you weren't on the board at the time, but we had a previous discussion regarding the state of Florida legislation, which essentially preempts the city from designating single-family homes against an owner's consent. Now, it doesn't prescriptively prohibit that. What the state law prohibits is any review regarding demolition. When any building is designated in the city, it automatically is subject to demolition review by this board. So because we cannot review demolition of single-family homes that have a finished floor located below the required base flood elevation, it essentially prohibits us from designating it, because when you designate a property, it's automatically protected in terms of demolition review. So, you know, the City Commission, I believe, had a discussion. We've had several iterations at the Land Use Committee regarding possible ideas for protection. We did have a joint meeting with the Design Review Board as well a few years ago. A lot of good recommendations came out of that. More recently, the board issued another series of recommendations that the commission was notified about. And that was former Commissioner Samulin actually was the sponsor of that. And you know, his untimely passing left that idle for a little bit, but Commissioner Fernandez has actually picked that item up, and not at this month's Land Use Committee meeting, but hopefully and in the March Land Use Committee meeting, we're going to be presenting some ideas for incentives. So right now it looks like the policy of the city is to try and explore incentives for people that would actually make a difference in retaining significant single-family homes. currently our hands are a bit tied with regard to demolition if the owner is not agreeing to that.
And are there, may I ask a question? Are there a list of those possible proposals of what the how we can incentivize the private sector?
I'm not sure because the item was deferred, so we don't have a formal. We've been working on some drafts. We're going to work with the sponsor, the commissioner who's sponsoring the item, to develop those formal recommendations, and that will be available, likely posted for the March Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. So that would be posted online. But a lot of them are some recommendations that came from this board.
I wanted to follow up on the other part of Rick's comment, which was about kind of strengthening, how to strengthen historic preservation staff in the city. And if there's anything that this board can do to support that those recommendations, because we know how important the work is that you all do, and whether there are any possible grant opportunities to bring in somebody, maybe a postdoc or something from on a yearly basis to kind of support the work of the office, because it just isn't getting lighter. In fact, it's becoming more and more relevant and important to the environment, to everything that we do about in the city. So if there's anything, if you have any thoughts on that, I think we'd like to hear them.
Okay. Off the top of my head, I don't. You can certainly recommend that the city commission look at funding sources to enhance this historic preservation staffing. One interesting thing that may come up, which may require additional staffing, is the city is looking just initially exploring this idea of TDRs. A TDR program, which would, require a significant amount of restoration for contributing buildings that may sell some of their unused development rights. And so that might be a program that, once we fully evaluate it and understand the implications, may also require some more support at the staff level.
Well, there's a contributing building. Are you doing a reanalysis of all the contributing buildings?
The survey is very labor intensive.
Of course,
and
yeah.
Right now, it would be great to resurvey all of the districts because we completed a mapping project several years ago, which kind of modernized our historic properties database. But in doing so, we realized that the corrections are probably warranted, and a resurvey is warranted. There's some buildings that may be contributing now that weren't in 1986 when we did the survey, and vice versa. There are some buildings that are either gone or have been altered and maybe were just mischaracterized at the time of designation. So, I think that would be a great use of resources to clean that all up. But unfortunately, it is extremely labor intensive. We have over 2,600 buildings in our historic district, and we would need to, look into each one of those.
And to put them in a database that was kind of connected, so the building cards were connected to that database, and then all of that will be huge importance, I think, when the city is looking at resiliency structures and strategies and testing.
And it would be a huge customer benefit
if
people could just go on and look at a property and then also get some supplemental documentation about that property. I agree, that would be an invaluable resource.
Could we recommend to the city commission that they put out a request for a proposal or look at funding an effort like this? It's going to take many man hours. It doesn't have to happen overnight, but there should be a plan in place for us to really know what we have if we're going to be talking about preserving them.
You could certainly make that recommendation to the mayor and commission that they explore funding opportunities or budget enhancements for the purpose of updating the historic properties database, including, a updated survey.
I believe the state of Florida, like certified local governments, can apply for up to $50,000 for surveying. And I know that like Fort Lauderdale and different cities have recently secured that funding. So that might be a good start.
Would the board like to make that recommendation? Yes. All those in favor? Okay, thank you. We will transmit that to the mayor and city commission.
And then, Kirk, a final farewell, man. Thank you again for your service.
Thank you all for everything.
There's Valentine's Day treats in the kitchen.
And staff as well. Thank you so
much. And Kirk gets the first pick.
We're going to miss you, Kirk.
You're welcome, Brian.
Meeting adjourned. And also, there's a list. We passed out a list of the 2023 meetings, so just take note of those and place them on your calendar.